Suffering 101 is a required class in life. Professor Payne is the teacher, and he is a tenured professor. And there are no course substitutions. You cannot cut class. You are required to participate. Put your finger in a bucket of water, and if when you remove it, you leave a hole, then you're special. And you don't have to worry about what we're talking about this morning. But when you lift that finger out of that water and there's no hole left, you're just like everybody else. And Suffering 101 is on your course schedule. Now, some of you here today, I look around and you look mighty young to me. And some of you might be thinking, well, I've not had to attend yet Suffering 101. Just keep living. And you will. So whether you are enrolled in that class or whether it's on your course schedule, either way, you need to hear what we're going to learn today from the book of Job. You see, suffering is universal. Pain is universal. And suffering is infinitely varied. It comes in all kinds of shapes and sizes and colors and hues. And what Job does is he offers you and me a rare peek through the keyhole of eternity. There's nothing quite like the book of Job in all of the Bible. Amazing book it is. I want to talk about some of the things in the first two chapters of Job, and then some of the things at the very end of Job when God himself addresses Job, and do so hopefully in the time limit that we have together today during this sermon. Now, everyone knows when we do wrong, we pay the consequences. And that's the way it should be, right? When the anvil or the Acme Say falls on Wile E. Coyote's head for chasing after the roadrunner, we all agree that's what should happen. He deserves it. He's getting what he deserves. It's his own fault. And when you drive your new Corvette 100 miles per hour down the road and you come to the hairpin turn and you can't make that turn and you wrap it around the telephone pole and you maim yourself or you kill yourself, everybody knows that's on you. And no question, no debate, that is on you. That's your fault. But what do you do when your two-year-old is diagnosed with cancer? What about that? What about when your teenager, who just turned 16 years of age, is killed by a drunk driver? What about when the police show up at your house at 2 a.m. in the morning? What do you do then? What about when that innocent train passenger is murdered by the man sitting behind her? The heart cries out and aches for an answer. But most of the time, there is no answer. Your mind can't rationalize it. You can't fit that on the shelf of life. What do you do when everything seems to be going fine? It's a sunshiny day and 72 degrees outside. Gentle breeze is blowing. And your bank account is in good shape. And your job is not in jeopardy. And things are going well with your family. And everything seems to be in good shape. And then suddenly, at the drop of a hat, at the turn of a corner, life shifts and everything falls apart. You know, that's what happened to Job. Don't dare tell me about the health and wealth gospel people. Don't talk to me about the name it and claim it people, the blab it and grab it people, the God wants you well people, the send me $100 while I live in a mansion somewhere and God will keep you well. Don't talk to me about those false prophets. And if you are foolish enough to listen to those who are not only false prophets but are preaching a false gospel and stand under the very judgment of God, you follow them, and you'll be in trouble. The key question in the book of Job is often misunderstood. Oh, David, it's all about suffering. It's all about why suffering, and why did Job suffer it? Why do the innocent suffer? Oh, no. No, that's not the key question. The key question is, what is the nature of God? You see, the issue is not really your suffering. You think it is. But the issue is not, why do I suffer? The issue is, what kind of God do I serve? I want you to think deeply about these things this morning. Who is God and what kind of God do I serve? The question of suffering for some people is theoretical. They like to talk about it over the dinner table, but it's theoretical. Others, I would be in this camp, it's theological. Let's talk about it theologically. Dr. Biles and I might sit across the table and talk about it theologically, but for all of us, it is personal. Not theoretical, not theological only, but it's personal. Everything in the book of Job ricochets off of the reality of pain. And the interesting thing about the book of Job is you can't, in fact, it is impossible to get armchair answers from wheelchair questions. It's not possible. And so Job, chapter 1, first five verses, is Disney-esque in what it says and does. Do you remember Sunday night when we were kids and the wonderful world of Disney? And on the television screen, there was that beautiful castle and that beautiful music and Tinkerbell with her wand and her magic dust, and she touches that castle with that music, and the rainbow colors spangle everywhere, and for the next 1 hour of your life, it's like being wrapped in a blanket of joy. The Disney-esque aspect of Job's life is what we read about in Job 1. There was a man in the country of Uz named Job. Now, guess what? We don't know where Uz was. We really don't have any idea. Well, we have some idea it was somewhere around Israel, but we don't really know where Uz was. Well, what's even more interesting is what is described about this man named Job. We are told four things about him. Number one, he's a man of complete integrity. Is that true of you? Number two, he's a man who feared God. Is that true of you? And he is a man who shunned evil. Is that true of you? He is a man who worshiped God and whose life was oriented around serving God. Is that true of you? This is Job's resume. This is the description of Job. We are told not only about his personal character, but we are told about his family. Seven sons, three daughters. Wow, 10 children. My granddaddy was the 10th of 10 children, born and raised in Valley Head, Alabama. He was the youngest of 10 children, born in 1911. 10 kids. Can you imagine growing up with a family of 10 children? I had 4 children in my family growing up. And my wife and I then had 4 children, and I thought that was a plenty. Can you imagine? 10. Wonderful family. Not only that, we learn not only about his character and his family, but about his wealth. His estate included 7,000 sheep and goats, 3,000 camels. Do you have any idea how expensive camels are today and were in the days of Job? And yet we're told Job had 3,000 of them. Can you imagine? 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, a very large number of servants. Wow, Job was the greatest man among all the people of the East. Can you imagine that? From the Nile River to the Euphrates River and everywhere in between, no one greater than Job. His name on everybody's lips. People talked about him all the time. Periodically, he was in the news. Job this, Job that, Job has this, Job did that. Not only that, we learn just how Job translated his love for God and obedience to God into active life. Because you see, his children, probably on their birthdays, would gather together and have a big party. And that probably occurred 10 times a year on their birthdays, likely. And what are we told in verses 4 and following? That whenever the round of banqueting was over, guess what Job would do? He would get up early in the morning. And he would offer burnt offerings for his children, and he would pray to God lest one of his children had inadvertently cursed God or disobeyed God or dishonored God in the partying. What a father. What a man. What conscious service and devotion to the Lord. And then we are told this was Job's regular practice. It's how he lived life. Think about that for just a moment. Is that how you live life? All until verse 6. Everything was sunny. Wonderful day. Until one day. One day, the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. You see, God has a cabinet meeting periodically. And apparently, God requires all of the orders of leaders of the angelic beings to appear before him to give account to him. And not only that, but guess who else had to come? That's right. Old Slewfoot the devil. And so we are told Satan also came with them. Like a criminal on parole, wearing an ankle bracelet, he slouches into the throne room. While the other angel leaders, Michael, Gabriel, and others, are gathered closer, there's the devil leaning against the back wall, slouched there with a toothpick in hand, picking his teeth. Sly and sassy. And God speaks to him. The Lord asks Satan, where have you come from? You see, even the devil, as Luther said, is God's devil. And the devil is accountable to God. Don't you think for one minute that God and the devil are equal. Oh, no. The devil is a created being. Though he rebelled against God, he's under the judgment of God. And one day will be cast into the lake of fire forever and ever. Yet now, he's on a leash. Even the devil's God's devil. He can't do anything he wants to, even without permission of God. He has to appear at the cabinet meeting with God himself. So what you been doing, boy? Where have you come from? The Lord asked. And Satan responds, from roaming through the earth, Satan answered him, and walking around on it. You see, he's like the emperor's spy. With a clipboard in hand, he goes around checking out who's doing what to see whom he can find to criticize and report to God. Aha, they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. And then the strangest thing happens. It's recorded in verse 8. Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? No one else on the earth is like him, a man of perfect integrity who fears God and turns away from evil." Now let me just ask you a question. Wouldn't you like to have that on your resume? Wouldn't you like to post on your Instagram, "Here's what God said about me"? Post that on your Facebook. "My servant," and there's your name. A person of integrity. No one else on earth like you. Wow. We would all love that, wouldn't we? This is what God said to Satan. Now, Satan's response in verse 9 is critical to the story. "Does Job fear God for nothing? Haven't you placed a hedge around him, his household, everything he owns? You've blessed the work of his hands. His possessions have increased in the land." In other words, God, you've blessed him. You've given him everything. You've given him luxury and a Lexus and all of this. You won't let anybody touch him. He's got it made. No wonder he serves you. But Lord, let me tell you what will happen. You take all that away, take away that luxury and that Lexus and give him leprosy, and he'll turn on you. And he'll curse you to your face. Watch what Satan is doing, which is what he's going to do to you. Satan is saying to God, "Okay, I can't find any sinful act to lay at your feet, God, on Job. But I can question his motive." Do you know how hard it is to question people's motives? Let me just tell you how hard it is. It is impossible. You don't know my motives. I don't know yours. But God does. Satan certainly doesn't know Job's motives. He thinks he does. We learn later he's totally wrong. But he tries to tell God about the motives of Job when God already knows Job's motive inside and out. Because God needs to learn nothing. He already knows it all. And so, Lord, this is why he's doing this. This is why he's serving you. Because you've protected him. You've blessed him. But if you take your hand of blessing off of him, he will curse you to your face. Amazing. The next story, part of the story, God says to Job, "Okay," God says to Satan, "have at him. Go ahead, let's test your theory, Satan. Let's see if what you say about old Job is true. And therefore, you can stretch out your hand and strike everything he owns, right? But you cannot lay a hand on Job himself." You know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of playing hide and seek when we were kids. And I found the best hiding place. And I was sequestered away and nobody was going to find me. And my little sister would come along and see me behind the bushes. And what would she do? Announce to the world, "Well, there's David. There he is. He's hiding right there behind the bush." Yeah, thanks, little sister. Drop dead. Here's Job. Satan doesn't bring up Job. God does. And Job, if he knew this, which he didn't know any of this was going on, in the same way that you have no clue what's going on in the imponderables of God and eternity and what's happening in heaven regarding your own life. You think you know. You have your ideas, but you have no clue what God's doing in your life. Neither did Job. He didn't know. But had he known, I'm sure he would have said, "Oh, dear Lord, don't pray. Don't point me out to him. Don't do that. Please don't do that. All right, he's in your hands. Very well, verse 12, everything he owns is in your power. Just don't lay a hand on him. Strange pre-war circumstances when the enemy general has to get permission from the general of the good army regarding attack and tactics, has to get approval before going to war. That's exactly what's happening here. It's unbelievable. It's utterly amazing. And by the way, when God stamps Satan's passport to enter your territory, no borders can keep him out. Let me tell you what you can't trust God about. Now, some of you all of a sudden woke up. There's something God can't be trusted about. Now, don't leave the building until you hear me out. God can't be trusted never to allow you to go through suffering when you didn't do anything wrong. Better mark that one down. Job did nothing wrong. The story explains that clearly. Furthermore, God put his stamp of approval, his God housekeeping seal of approval on Job. He's upright. He's a man of integrity. He serves me, does all of this. And yet, in spite of that, God, why did you give permission to Satan to strike Job that way? And guess what? No answer. Nor does God give an answer to you either for why he does that. No answer. He just does it. Because God is God. And Job's piety, we learn, was not dependent upon his prosperity, but also righteousness does not guarantee exemption from suffering. Oh, you're a good church member. Here you are this morning. You're disappointed. You thought the pastor was preaching. And so it's a little bit of a downer. And the long-winded professor of preaching is actually up to bat. But nevertheless, you're here because you're a faithful church member. And you're a faithful Christian. You're a member of Sunnyvale, and you're a tither. And so why should God let things go wrong in my life? Why should God let Satan wreak some havoc in my life? And there is no answer to that question. And by the way, some people want to try to get rid of the problem of suffering by just getting rid of God, and so they become atheists. That's the stupidest thing you can do. Listen, you don't get rid of the problem of suffering by thinking you can get rid of God. No. In fact, the only way you're going to ever solve the problem of suffering and understand the issue of suffering is with God. And no other way. It's very easy to get touchy with God when he doesn't act according to our theology. God, that's not the way it reads in my theology book. This is not the way this works. I've served you, I've loved you, I've tithed to my church, I've been faithful. I don't talk negatively about my pastor. I don't stir up strife and trouble in my church. I don't argue at a business meeting. Lord, you ought to cut me some slack for that. I ought to get a little consideration. Why this suffering? Come on, God. Easy to get touchy with God. Yeah, Satan got permission from God to do to Job what he did, but he didn't get permission from me to do it. He didn't ask me. I would have said, no, can't touch me. Who do you think you are? But you see, the problem is you're not in charge. Let me tell you the other problem. It is not about you in the first place. You came in here and sat down thinking it is. We're the king on the thrones of our lives. It's true of me, it's true of you, it's how we often think. Nothing like the book of Job to dethrone self. And that needs to happen to some of us. It needs to happen to some of you. It needs to happen to me. And so Satan goes out to shorten this story. And he does four things. He destroys Job's wealth. He destroys the animals. He destroys the sheep. He destroys all of Job's agricultural means of wealth. And finally, Satan destroys Job's 10 children. He kills them. Did you hear what I said? Satan destroys Job's children and God let him do it. I don't know about you, but that doesn't compute in my computer. I can't understand that. I can't wrap my mind around that. I don't understand that. Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking, and a powerful wind swept in and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on the young people, and they died, and I alone have left to respond and tell you about it. At that point, as if that is not surprising and amazing and astounding enough, I read verse 20. Then Job stood, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell to the ground, and worshiped. Is that what you would do? Fell to the ground and worshiped. And then this is what he said. Naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked I will leave this life. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. It's not about you, Job. In the midst of all of that, instead of self-pity, Job worships God and says, blessed be the name of the Lord. He gives and he takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Is that what you say? When all hell breaks loose, when everything falls apart, when there's trouble all around, when there seems no answer, when there seems no way forward, when there is darkness and not light, is that how you respond? I'm afraid most of us don't respond that way. And you know why? Because it's all about you. And it's all about me. It's not all about God, whom it should be all about. Who are you, God, to allow this to happen to me or to cause this to happen to me? You see, all suffering is either directly caused by God or it's permitted by God. One of the two. Sometimes God causes things. Sometimes God permits other things that he doesn't personally directly cause, but Satan causes, or he allows others to cause. But either way, it was within his power to stay his hand and stop it. But he permitted it. I don't like that, God. I don't understand that, God. I don't know why you operate that way, God. At the end of verse chapter 1, verse 22, throughout all of this, Job did not sin or blame God for anything. He did not sin by action, nor did he sin by word throughout it all. Is that true of you? I don't know about you, but my problem is my mouth. Now, I realize you look upon me and say, oh, well, I'm not Dr. Allen. Oh, yeah, Dr. Allen. My problem can be my mouth. I shoot it off when I shouldn't, and so do you. Especially about things you know nothing about. And especially dangerous is for you to do that about God. God, why? God, what? What? Why? What's the deal here? Whoa. Job learned you better be real careful about doing that with God. So Satan returns, chapter 2. And the Lord asked Satan, where have you come from? And the same answer, I've been, around. My theme song is Johnny Cash's I've Been Everywhere, Man. And the Lord said, have you considered my servant Job? No one else like him, etc., etc. The very same thing God said in the first encounter, he repeats verbatim in the second encounter, but with an addition. He retains his integrity, even though you incited me against him to destroy him for no good cause. Now, there is a cause. Don't make a mistake here. There's a reason. God does nothing without a reason. God knows what he's doing. He just doesn't tell you. He just doesn't take you and me into his confidence about what he does and why he does what he does. And Satan says, look, skin for skin. A man will give up everything he owns in exchange for his life. You stretch out your hand, strike his flesh and bones, and he'll curse you to your face. In other words, look, you've touched stuff he had, but you won't let me touch him. But if you let me touch him, you let me give him some kind of disease or whatever, and let me tell you what will happen. God, he will curse you to your face. You know why? Because Job is serving you for what he can get out of you. That's his motivation. Satan lecturing God. That's his motivation. And so the Lord answered Satan, he's in your power, only spare his life. Remember, the devil is on the leash. All right, have at it, but you can't kill him. Satan left the Lord's presence like an excited 16-year-old who just got his driver's license and he's ready to wreak havoc. And that's exactly what he does. He touches Job's body. He afflicted him with sores, boils, soles of his feet, top of his head. Job took a piece of broken pottery to scrape himself because of the disastrous physical consequences of probably what he had was a form of leprosy. Incurable in that day, a living death that ultimately ended in death, no hope, no future, a terrible way to die. And there he is sitting in the ash heap of the town. And Mrs. Job speaks. Mrs. Job said, are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die. Don't be too harsh on Mrs. Job. It was her 10 children who were dead in fresh graves too. And it may be that she is speaking out of anger against God for what God did to her children in her perspective and her husband, and therefore she says out of anger, curse God and die. On the other hand, in Hebrew, it may be a matter of sympathy. Her heart breaking for her husband, her children are dead, and she sees the plight of her husband, and out of sympathy she says, God's clearly turned on you, turn your back on him and go ahead and die. Get out of this suffering. You see, her rationale is this. Job was cursed for no reason. So Job, my husband, you've got good reason to curse God. That's her logic. But either way, whether out of anger or whether out of sympathy, it doesn't matter. At that moment, she became the mouthpiece of the devil. Wives, be careful what you say to your husbands. Don't become the mouthpiece of the devil and compound things in your home. And so Job immediately won't let that go by. "You speak as a foolish woman speaks," he told her. Now, that's sort of a nice way of expressing it in English. But basically, the expression is a little bit stronger than that. You know, you're sort of like a crazy woman. You're like an ungodly pagan woman who has no clue what she's talking about. Sort of what Job tells her. You see, she was trying to get Job to do exactly what Satan wanted him to do. Curse God. Do you see that? Falling into the trap of Satan herself and didn't even know it. And Job reminds her, hey, God is the giver, but he also has the prerogative to be the withholder. And he has to teach his wife. Should we accept only good and not adversity? And yet, number two, we're told twice now, yet throughout all of this, Job didn't sin. She did. She sinned. But Job didn't. In all of the suffering, Job didn't sin. And then Job's three friends show up. Bad news travels fast. And though they lived a distance away, they had heard about Job's calamity and they came. And at first they were wise. They sat down with Job, spoke not a word, identified with him in his suffering and in silence. And the ministry of presence is what they gave to Job, which is what you should do when you come, when your friend or family member experiences that tragedy. Don't step into their living room and explain to them what God is doing. Because you don't know. You don't have a clue. Therefore, shut up. Shut it. Just go in the living room, sit down beside them, hold their hand, and cry with them. That's what Job's three friends did. They did that right. But then, in the middle part of Job, chapter 3, all the way to the beginning of chapter 38, there is a back and forth boxing match verbally between Job and his three friends. And in that verbal boxing match, Job says, man, it's terrible. I didn't do anything wrong. I wish I were dead. And he says a lot of other things. And then one by one, his three friends in answer, and they're a speech here and a response, and then another speech in response. And for chapter after chapter after chapter, that's what you have in the middle of the book of Job. And Job proclaims his innocence. And his friends say, no, it's the retribution principle, Job. You're suffering because you've sinned. If you just repent of it, God will take away your suffering. That's called the retribution principle. Now be careful. Sometimes you do suffer because of your sin. Can you put that t-shirt on and does it fit? You bet. Sometimes we suffer because of our own sin. We make bad choices and we suffer the consequences of those bad choices. That's on us. But Job said, I didn't do anything wrong this time. It's not on me. And Job's friends said, no, Job, you're mistaken. Finally, they just say, Job, you're lying. And that goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then comes chapter 38. And God shows up. Do you remember the movie Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves with Kevin Costner? Do you remember how the movie ended? He and Maid Marian finally are getting married. And there they are, and all the friends are around. And the padre is performing the ceremony. And if anyone can say anything, any reason why these two should not be joined together, let him now speak or forever hold his peace. And there's a moment of silence, and then there are horses in the distance. You see them intermittently through the trees, and a voice speaks, hold, I speak. An inimitable voice which turns out to be the voice of King Richard, returning from the Crusades, played by Sean Connery. And when he steps into the camera, everybody kneels before King Richard. Hold, I speak. Now, after everybody's spoken, everybody's had their say. Job's had his say. His three friends have had their say. Job's wife's had her say. Everybody has spoken. And now, God says, hold it. I speak. And from chapters 38 all the way to 42:6, God speaks. You know what God does? Instead of bringing answers to all of Job's questions, do you know how many questions there are in the book of Job, by the way? Anybody know? 300. But instead of answering all of Job's questions about why, God steps in and says, Job, sit down in my classroom, and I'm about to give you a pop quiz. And God peppers Job with 77 questions, one after another. And guess what? Job can't answer a single one. He doesn't make an 80, a 70, a 60, a 50 on that pop quiz. No, he makes a zero. He can't answer a single question. And I guess not, because the questions are very unusual. They're about astronomy and oceanography and meteorology and zoology and so forth. Job, can you explain to me how the stars do what they do? Can you explain where the water in the ocean comes from? How is ice made? How does that work? How does the wind blow? And God peppers Job with questions, and Job can't answer a single question. God says, let me take you to my zoo. And so he walks him through six animals and four birds. He tells him about the stupidity of the ostrich and the glory of the eagle. He starts with the lion, the king of animals, and he ends with the eagle, the king of the birds. And then God says, do you understand how all this works? Who created them? Were you there when they were created? And can you explain how all of that works? And Job is left dumb. He can't answer a single question. And so after all of that, after God's science quiz in chapter 40, and verse 1, the Lord answered Job, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who argues with God give an answer. And now Job responds very briefly, I am so insignificant. How can I answer you? I place my hand over my mouth. I've spoken once. I will not reply twice. How can I? I can add nothing. Job is beginning to learn his lesson that when God shows up and puts you through his pop quiz and you make a zero, you really don't have much ground to stand on. And so, then the Lord answers Job again, get ready, verse 6, because I'm going to question you some more. Will you really challenge my justice, and will you declare me guilty to justify yourself? I want you, church family, to look at those two questions. Stay with me just a little bit longer. Two questions there. Will you challenge my justice, and will you declare me guilty to justify yourself? There is your problem, and there is my problem. It's God's fault, not me. And my self-defense causes me to want to justify myself at the expense of God's right to do in my life what he wants to do, period. Until you get to that point, you are always going to struggle with your suffering. You are never going to figure it out. You're never going to have peace. You're always going to struggle with your suffering. And so God puts Job through another round of questions, another round of statements about who he is and what he does. And Job becomes like Ralphie in the Christmas story. He wants that Red Ryder BB gun so badly. But when the time comes and he gets to actually sit on Santa's lap, He totally goes blank. He can't remember anything to say. And that's what happens to Job. And at the end of it all, in 42:1, Job finally makes his last statement. He said, I know that you can do anything. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked me, who is this who conceals my counsel? I spoke about things I didn't understand, things too wonderful for me. I've heard reports about you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I reject my words, and I'm sorry for them. I am dust and ashes. God said to Job, in the game of let's pretend to be God, Job cannot take a 50-50, nor can he poll the audience, nor can he phone a friend. His three best friends came, and they were all wrong. He can't do any of that. He has no answer. And the question, who wants to be like God? And that's what God says to Job. You think you want to be like me? I want you to pretend to run the universe. Can you do that? That's what all chapter 41 is about. Surely if you criticize my governance, Job, you know how to run the universe. Surely you must. You've got to know something about the rotation of the earth and how the light and darkness come and go. But Job has no clue. No clue whatsoever. And so in 42:1-6, he pleads his ignorance. He realizes he has been face to face with God himself, and he repents, which is what you and I should do. You see, the question of what should I do today, likely for most of us, it's repent. 5 times out of 7 in the letters to the 7 churches in Revelation, as Jesus spoke to his churches, what did he tell 5 of the 7 to do? Repent.
We're so glad that you joined us virtually.
Job learned it's not about him. And the critic turns into a worshiper. And that's what God wants of you today. I walked a mile with pleasure. She chattered all the way, but I was none the wiser for all she had to say. I walked a mile with sorrow. And not a word said she, but oh, the things I learned from her when sorrow walked with me. To those who have suffered and asked why. To those who've asked why and discovered that's the wrong question. To those who asked the right question, who, and discovered the answer. Him. That's what Job is all about.